much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, a Thursday afternoon. The umbrellas are out on Michigan Avenue, but I think those are just the pessimists, Dennis Rodkin. It's not really going to rain, do you think?
I don't know. There was a little bit of spit coming from the sky earlier, just tiny little bits.
Oh, that's even weirder. Dennis Rodkin is here from Crane Chicago Business, writes about real estate. So we have Dennis come in every week or every other week or so to talk about some of the stories. There's a lot to talk about this week. Later in the program, we will talk to John Byrne about marketing, John Duffy, I should say. And there was a big study out on people using the internet and the numbers, and it actually was flat from 2014 to 15. So maybe we've reached saturation when it comes to the internet.
Wow. That's a surprise.
Let's talk about home sales. Now, we got a lot of numbers to go through here. Mm-hmm. Chicago homes are not increasing in value very fast. Right. But they are outpacing income, so it's becoming. Even though the prices aren't going up very fast for the people who want to sell, they're going up too fast maybe for the people who want to buy.
Exactly. Yeah, we did an index. We compared prices and household incomes for 25 years from 1991 to 2015, and in the past 3 years, prices have been rising considerably faster than incomes. In the 1990s, the two were sort of hand in hand, and for a very brief heyday after the bust, for 2011 and 2012, they were back to being what I think of as like 1990s normalcy, where affordability was sort of in balance. But even though our prices are not climbing fast, our prices are climbing at one-tenth the rate the home prices in Portland are climbing, to give you an idea of just how slow we are compared to other cities. Even though our prices aren't going up fast, they're going up considerably faster than incomes.
Okay, so a couple things. Is that the goal? Should incomes and home prices be rising sort of parallel?
What you would like. I mean, okay. That's what prevailed in the 1990s, and it would be nice. I don't think that you could say they should, but it would be really cool if they did.
So if the income is lower, that's probably keeping the home prices lower as well, even though they're going up faster.
You would think. But one thing to keep in mind is that this is a region-wide gauge.
Uh-huh.
So one individual person's income may have gone up quite a bit, and one individual home's value may have gone up quite a bit. But what we're talking about is across the board, incomes across Chicago, the Chicago metro area, and home prices across. So it's hard to get, I mean.
Am I revealing that numbers aren't my thing yet? Is that?
Well, it's also, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is I do, you know, we've talked about some real localized stories I've done where we're looking at individual zip codes
hot,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in this case, what we're looking at is for the region.
Okay. So one more time then, if the home prices are outpacing, salaries or income here,
then homes are becoming less affordable.
But the home prices here are rising 20 times more slowly, if you'll allow that.
Right.
In Portland, it must be a much bigger problem than other parts of the country.
Yeah, well, you know, one person was talking to me, I didn't get it into the story, about how in San Francisco you can have people making $200,000 who can't afford to live without a roommate. I mean, that's not true here. You know,
yeah.
I mean, there are, and when you read the stories about the Airbnb guy offering his upper bunk, you know, a guy offering on Airbnb the upper bunk and he's sleeping in the lower, those kinds of things, you see that it is happening. But yeah, I mean, relative to other cities, our homes are still among the most affordable in the nation, but they are rising. Affordability is shrinking.
All right, let's do the underwater number, too, because that's another place where we tend to do very well.
Hand in hand with the numbers we were discussing.
We're number one when it comes to homes that are mortgaged more than they're worth.
Yeah, but it's not. Number one is the opposite of the position
we'd
like to be in.
Yeah,
we took over from Las Vegas. An underwater homeowner is somebody who owes more on the mortgage than the house is worth. And we have been near the bottom, near the worst end of that list for quite a while. But Las Vegas for over 4 years was the city with the most underwater homeowners. And in the first quarter of 2016, Las Vegas got better than Chicago. So Chicago now has the largest percentage of underwater homeowners of 35 major cities in America, 20.3%.
Yeah, just about one out of five, right?
Yeah.
So if you've got a block with 15 houses on it, three of them are underwater.
Yeah.
And those would all be homes that were recently purchased, right, or purchased within the past 10 or 15 years?
Well, not necessarily. No. There are people, I see this sort of thing happen in the records all the time. There are people who've had the house for 20 years, but who mortgaged it to the hilt, or 30 years, and who mortgaged it to the hilt in recent, or in the run-up. Or I inherited it from my mom, and I tried to milk all the equity out of it via borrowing, and then I'm underwater, that sort of thing.
The good news is we were at 40% not too long ago, right?
Yeah, in 4 years, we've cut in half our proportion of underwater buyers, but in Las Vegas, it's shrunk by, it's down to less than a third of what it was 4 years ago. So Las Vegas is healing a lot faster than we are in terms of underwater home owners.
Okay, we've got a minute. Let's go to Temple.
Okay.
Take me to this Jewish temple, a synagogue, on the north side. That developers are trying to save, really.
Yeah, I will probably pronounce it wrong. I always do, but it's something like Agudas Akim. It was once the biggest Hungarian synagogue outside Hungary. It's one of the biggest and possibly the most lavish ever built in Chicago.
I love in your story, at its height during the High Holy Days, it would seat 2,200 people, but there were so many people in this congregation that they would have to go to the Aragon Ballroom.
Yeah, go to one of those palaces nearby because they had so much. They seat 2,200 and they had too many people at the High Holidays.
And then by the 80s,
they couldn't get a quorum of, they frequently couldn't get a quorum of 10 men, which is what a synagogue needs in order to have services on a Saturday. So yeah, it had really shrunk, and that has a lot to do with people moving out of the city and that sort of thing. And really since the 80s, it's had a lot of deferred maintenance. And I was inside it's crumbling. It's a spectacular space. If you can look past the crumble, it's got this arc that is about 30 feet high and just encrusted in mosaic tile and then surrounded by an arch of stained glass. You can't even believe what you're looking at.
We got to keep going here. But so this developer looks at properties like this, wants to save it.
Right.
How do you put houses in a huge open space like that?
I have no idea. They're still working on it. They've done a lot. They're doing the Bush Temple of Music over on Chicago Avenue, several others. A pub, I can't remember, Miller's, the pub that's on Wabash, they're doing the high, South Wabash, they're doing a high rise there into a residential. But the, in the case of this synagogue, it's got this, you know, it's this massive sanctuary. The ceiling's 60 feet high.
Right.
The space is like 40 feet wide. They'll probably have to jack a whole new floor or maybe two into that space. It probably doesn't look like a synagogue when they're done, but who knows?
On the inside. Well, wish them luck because it's nice that we're saving this building.
Yeah, it'll be nice to walk past the outside and at least see the history, even if the inside has changed considerably.
Dennis Rodkin, you can read more at chicagobusiness.com. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Are you hungry? Chris Lardakis has brought food, and you can't eat it over the radio, can you? Chris, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you very much.
Chris is one of the guys behind the Canela Breakfast Club, the ever-expanding Canela Breakfast Club, right?
Yes. Right now we are on our fifth location.
All right, so, and that's in Andersonville.
Correct. The fifth just opened in Andersonville.
Tell me about the first one and how long ago it was.
So the first one was about 5.5 years ago in Lakeview, a few blocks away from Wrigley Field, approximately Clark and Belmont area.
Okay, so we're talking about one a year.
Absolutely, yeah.
This was described in a piece I read as a mini chain. Do you consider it a mini chain?
Yeah, I would say it's like a mini family chain. You know, we're not necessarily like a franchise, but we're just like a, you know, a good-sized little family
right.
That's
because
trying to expand.
Because there comes a transition, right, where you tend to, once it gets a little too big, you might lose a little bit more control, too.
Exactly. Everything's all about consistency and keeping, you know, just the brand together.
Right.
And not losing focus on that.
All right, tell me about the Breakfast Club. What kind of, is it Greek breakfast?
So it's a contemporary breakfast, lunch, brunch spot with a little bit of Greek influence, obviously, because myself and my partner, Alexi Junos, we are Greek, and we like to influence some Greek into our breakfast.
Uh-huh.
Everything is locally sourced. We use a ton.
You ever heard of Greek yogurt? It's big, you know?
Oh, our Greek yogurt's the best. Oh, absolutely. And just everything's scratch in-house, you know, and we offer a lot of, like, fresh squeezed juices, smoothies. We just partnered up with Boat Trust Coffee, so we have a really great brand of coffee at our restaurant. And we have a full liquor bar of great brunch cocktails, Bloody Marys, mimosas.
No kidding.
Is
that tough to get the liquor license?
You know, I think because we're open from 6 or 7 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Not the same thing.
It's not the same thing as owning a bar and trying to get a liquor license. And it's Bloody Marys, mimosas. It's very simple, you know, easy cocktails.
All right, so you mentioned Alexis Gianulis, who was the former state treasurer.
Yes.
Ran for Senate 6 years ago against Mark Kirk. What's it like having a politician as a partner?
Oh, amazing. He's just, he's like a mentor as well.
He's not listening. You can tell me.
Oh, yeah. Nah, he's great because, you know, we get along so well. And we communicate very well, and we're able to expand these locations, you know, by doing our due diligence and, you know, finding the right locations, having patience.
Right. And so it's nice to, I mean, I think you've been growing pretty fast. I mean, I think 5 in 5 years is pretty fast growth.
So you must
have a good sort of cohesive core behind you to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Having Alexi as a partner, he almost grounds us so that way we make smart, educated decisions,
right,
and take it slow, but also if there's a good opportunity that comes by, let's not lose that opportunity.
Did I read that one of your chefs got into a, took justice into his own hands?
Yes, our executive chef, Don Penza, in our Wicker Park location, he just happened to be sitting in a back parking lot of ours and saw some man trying to break into one of our employees' cars, and he chased them down Milwaukee Avenue.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah.
And it worked out well for him?
Oh, absolutely. And literally was able to, you know, catch him and hold him down until the police showed up.
And I don't speak Greek. We were doing a little Greek geography off the air. But canela means
cinnamon.
Cinnamon, okay.
Yes.
And so it's the Cinnamon Breakfast Club in a way.
Yes.
Will you ever go into dinner?
You know, we thought about it, but, you know, just because the breakfast scene works so well,
right.
We don't want to alter it. And also...
And why would you, really?
Yeah, why would you? And the hardest part is finding great staff. And we have really good staff right now, and it gets harder when you try to open up for dinner and get that second shift of staff.
Then. Right, so I think I got, what, Lakeview, Streeterville, Wicker Park,
Old
Andersonville...
Town.
Old Town, what's next?
So, you know, we're scouting River North, West Loop, possibly South Loop. You know, trying to hit, like, the neighborhoods that are almost in the same proximity where it's easy to drive to.
We're talking to Chris Lydakis from the Canela Breakfast Club. We got to go. But what is your biggest reward for you emotionally, personally, doing this business? What pays off for you?
So I'm all about customer service and just getting positive, great satisfaction of people saying, wow, I had an amazing brunch. It just makes me feel really good.
That's nice. Well, good luck with that. I hope you have continued success.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having us on air.
Bet. Is there a website? How do people find you?
So they can find us on Instagram, our Twitter handle at Canela Cafe. And especially on Facebook as well, so you can catch us on there.
Or walk down the street. You'll run into one eventually.
Oh, yeah. And it comes sit on our beautiful patios, especially for the spring and summer.
Nice to talk to you. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and the Canela Breakfast Club was in just a little bit ago, the last segment. Right now, we're going to talk to John Byrne, the co-host of Monday Morning Marketing at WGN Plus. And, John, you know, it's just a heck of a time for you to be on the phone because, well, gee whiz, there's chicken and waffles here. There's some strawberry pancakes. There's all kinds of stuff that I asked them to bring in specifically for you.
You know, I'm really sad that I'm not there. You were making me hungry. I was listening to the last segment online.
I would save it for you, too, but I just don't think it keeps very well. So we'll take care of it today.
I'm sure you will.
Tell me about Mary Meeker. I had not ever heard of her, and apparently she comes out with this predictive survey that is closely followed.
Yeah, so Mary Meeker is a partner at a big Silicon Valley VC firm, venture capital firm, called Kleiner Perkins, and she started doing this several years ago, and it really comes out, and people anticipated it. She does a ton of work, ton of research. You know, a lot of venture capital firms have huge research arms for obvious reasons, and the information she turns out every year is just fascinating, and it's really the gold standard in the industry.
All right, so one of the things that jumps out is the fact that, I mean, that the Internet usage is huge, but has it topped off? I mean, it seems as if it was flat from 2014 and 15.
Well, it was growth that was flat. I mean, you know, there's still more people going on the Internet. Worldwide, there's about 3 billion people, which is just a little under half of the world's population is using the Internet, which when you think about it is pretty incredible. But the growth from year to year has totally flattened out, with the exception of India, believe it or not. In India, people are still going online at gangbusters every year. And in fact, India now has more internet users than China.
No kidding.
Only to the, Yeah, and second only to the United States in the number of internet users.
All right, so another thing, and I want to talk about the advertisement and marketing and how we would use these numbers, but the other thing that Mary Meeker predicts is that in 5 years or so, we won't be typing in our queries to Google, which I think will be a difficult thing for me. Explain that.
Well, so the advent of really voice recognition software and really good visual recognition software, I think is going to, according to Mary, lead to people just doing things like, and people try it now, by the way, you know, Siri, find me the nearest Canela restaurant, right? You know, and it kind of works not so much. And what she's predicting as the technology just keeps getting better and better, it's just as easy for you to, in fact, it's a lot easier to talk into your phone saying, you know, who has the best rated pizza in Chicago than it would be to type that out.
Right. But the thing for me is, you know, I will sit here and do the show with my phone near me. And I would say just about every other day, Siri pops up and asks me what I want because she hears something that sounds like Siri and then the phone comes on. So they've got a long way to go there.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, Amazon has the product Alexa. I'm not part of that. We have, in fact, Elise, my co-chair, has one, and it's interesting.
Oh, I thought you meant there was one. I thought you meant there was one named after Elise. I totally missed that.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe there should.
Okay, let's talk about internet advertising. That you know, it continues to go up, but it's really more about mobile than it is desktop, right? In fact, I was surprised by how much mobile sort of dominates the desktop advertising.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what advertisers are realizing is that, and the growth in terms of the usage of mobile is what's driving this. So, I mean, people, when they go and they interact with media, whether they're, you know, reading a story on a news site or if they're just even looking at social media or whatever, I mean, they spend 25% of the time that they engage with some kind of media, 25% of that is on their mobile device. So, and that includes, by the way, watching TV, right? I mean,
sure.
So, That is just, it exploded from where it was. When you think about it, smartphones didn't even exist barely 10 years ago, right? So just in the span of 10 years now, fully a quarter of our time that we spend interacting with media is now on mobile. The interesting thing is that the marketers haven't totally bought into it, which is sort of sunny in a way, because there's a lot of people who still think that advertising in print, on a magazine or newspaper, is still the way to go. And people are only spending about 4 or 5% of their time that they spend with media reading. They're at least reading things that are printed.
I saw that, and so, let me see if I can find that. So print newspapers only attract 4% of people's media time, but 16% of all ad spending is done in print. So you've
absolutely.
Got maybe, you know, if you line up those percentages, four times the money for the people reading it. But it seems like if you're targeting someone, you can do it. I don't know, John. I was going to say you could do it more easily in print than you could online because people online are jumping all over the place, but that's targeting is not the right word. It seems like maybe it's still more reliable to know who you're reaching when you put it in a newspaper.
Well, you're talking, I think, about market segmentation. And
I am, very ineloquently, thank you, yes.
But absolutely, depending on the publication, you can totally expect sort of more bang for the buck in terms of advertising in a particular publication that when you want to reach a particular audience. But from a mass market, you know, from general television or cable or even something like the New York Times is relatively mass market in comparison to, you know, a trade publication. The print is just dying in that way of terms of the amount of time people spend with it. Now, what's happened is some of them have also transferred over onto a mobile platform. And you're right, people jump around. The interesting thing that Mary Meeker pointed out as a potential trend is right now when you look at your smartphone and you start it up, you've got like a home screen that has all your apps on it or whatever. They're thinking that, she's predicting that there's going to be a big turn toward having whatever messaging solution that you use, whether that's Facebook Messenger or Snapchat or whatever, that you communicate with your friends and neighbors, so to speak. That will end up being more of your homepage than just this selection of apps with a, you know, family picture in the background kind of thing.
So you'll go straight to Messenger or something like that rather than the beginning page.
Right. And what's going to happen, I think, is the ads will follow you as you navigate through your phone as opposed to, like you said, you're sort of, and it's what's happening, and people are having a hard time translating. I have a hard time translating. You're thinking, the experience of staring at a desktop on your phone, and they're two different things.
Right. So, right. So if you look at your desktop, there's a lot of space there for ads on banners or whatever that doesn't really exist on a phone. So if you're marketing, you've got to figure out a whole new way to go at it.
And one thing that Snapchat has started doing, and then this is, again, it's in Meeker's report, is they've figured out this way of doing video advertising on Snapchat. And Snapchat's huge with kids and your kids' generation, my kids' generation, obviously. But it's funny, they call it the 3Ds, and it's vertical. So that's the orientation of a phone, which when you think about it, you're like, well, of course. But then think back, when was the last time you really looked at a bunch of ads that were vertical as opposed to horizontal?
Right.
But also video for greater storytelling, and then viewing. Ads are always full screen. So they kind of take over the phone and they capture your attention, and they're really doing well. These kids are watching advertising on Snapchat. It's kind of scary. And that's sort of the future of mobile advertising is going to be that idea. It's going to maybe be on your phone, the only thing on your phone for a few seconds, but it's going to be engaging you enough that you'll remember it. As opposed to being this teeny tiny little bar at the top.
We're just about out of time, but one more sort of plea or just a point of information. When we talk about these studies and how people look at media and how much time they spend, they're spending 13% of their day getting their media from radio, which is almost three times that of print, but only 10% of the advertising is going toward radio. So we're a little undervalued here, John. I think it's time for some people to step up.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think that people have tremendously undervalued radio.
John,
I think we should be putting more advertising on.
I think we should. In fact, you know what, John? I think we're going to do it right about now.
Sounds good.
I'll talk to you next week. John Byrne is the co-host of Monday Morning Marketing. You can hear that at WGNplus.com. This is The Business Lunch. Music of Moreland and Arbuckle from Alligator Records. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. It's a pleasure to welcome Bruce Iglauer to the Business Lunch, the guy behind Alligator Records and the guy celebrating 45 years at Alligator this summer. Bruce, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
You know, we've talked from time to time over the years, and I was a big fan of your record label. I think I joined it. You had a deal like at one time, like the Columbia Record Club, I think, where you can get 10 albums for $3 or something like that.
We made some very nice deals in the past, but now, of course, a lot of people want to buy downloads or listen to streams rather than owning CDs.
Yeah.
So we try to accommodate everyone.
So how has the, we know how the music industry has changed, I guess. How has the blues industry changed from 1971 to 2016?
Well, when I came to Chicago, I came to Chicago for the blues. When I came to Chicago in 1970, all the blues in the city was being performed on the South Side and the West Side, primarily in little neighborhood clubs. These days, blues is a worldwide music. I hear great blues bands from Australia, from Europe, even from South America, as well as, of course, from Chicago and many other places in the States. So it's become an international language.
Has the sound changed at all?
Well, the sound continues to change, but slowly. You know, blues is a traditional music, and it absorbs new instruments and new sounds from time to time. So you'll occasionally see people with synthesizer keyboards in blues bands, but primarily you're still going to see guitars and harmonicas and pianos and bass and drums.
You know, it's funny. I was looking over your catalog, and the people, I want to talk about this, the music you're releasing this summer, but Little Ed and the Blues Imperials is one of the groups, and I remember when they were like this great new young upstart band. They're kind of one of the veterans around town now.
Right. We first recorded them back in 1984, and the personnel of the band changed a little bit after that, but the same four guys have been in that band for 27 years.
Wow.
And Ed sounds just the same, and proudly so, just the same as he did in the 80s, and he was very influenced by his uncle, a wonderful blues musician from the 50s named J.B. Hutto. So Ed's a real throwback to the traditional Chicago sound.
And we're talking because Blues Fest is coming up this weekend, and it sounds like Friday is pretty much going to be an Alligator Records Day at Blues Fest.
The Blues Festival folks have been very nice to us. During the afternoon, Moreland and Arbuckle, whom you just played a bit of, and Curtis Salgado, a wonderful soul singer, will be performing at the Crossroads stage. And then on the band shell, the main stage, Friday evening, we have Tommy Castro with a special guest appearance by Chicago's own blues man bus driver, Toronto Cannon, and then Little Ed and the Blues Imperials with Corky Siegel, whom some of your listeners may remember from the Siegel Schwall Band.
Sure.
And finally, the queen of the blues, the young queen of the blues, Shamika Copeland, and Curtis Salgado will be doing a guest shot with her. So these will be some combinations of musicians that people don't often get a chance to hear.
Now, you recorded Coco Taylor, right? I mean, I know she recorded elsewhere, but she did some work with Alligator.
Oh, we had Coco on the label for 35 years, yeah. from 1974 till she passed in 2009. She and I traveled all over the world together.
Eddie, the Chief Clearwater, is still playing?
Oh, yeah. Eddie is in his early 80s, but you sure can't tell by listening to him. And he puts out a great show, too. He'll come out. You know, he has Native American heritage, and he'll come out on stage on Sunday when he plays in his war bonnet.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how times have changed, right? Because when he started, he wasn't using the term Native American heritage, and he wasn't having to explain his war bonnet, but... Here we are in 2016. Well, look,
exactly.
You've got a sort of a compilation, a collection of music out, and if people want to find it, how do they get a hold of that?
Well, actually, it's coming out tomorrow.
Beautiful.
It's the Alligator Records 45th Anniversary Collection. It's two CDs, 158 minutes of music for the price of one, and it's available as a physical CD in what few good record stores remain, or through Amazon or the other mail order services. It's available as a download through iTunes, Amazon, and just about anyone else that you could think of. And it's available as a stream through Apple Music or Spotify. It's all songs that I handpicked for the collection and remastered so they sound even better than the original releases.
Well, Alligator Records is a Chicago gem, an institution, really, and quintessential Chicago in so many ways. So congratulations on the anniversary, and I hope you have a great day at the Blues Fest coming up on Friday.
Thanks. I sure hope that everybody can come out. It's supposed to be lovely weather, hot but clear, and come out and spend the whole day and evening at the Blues Festival. It is the largest blues festival in the world, and it's absolutely free.
This is your city. Give it a hug. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.